SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough! Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
Very good Thursday, race fans, Sirius 219, except 201, Sports Zone 964, if you're listening to SiriusXM online, and at our website, stevebick.com, and I hear music. What was that case? We're going to take a break right away? we weren't 5 seconds into the show. We have to start this morning pretty immediately, actually, before I talk about the nice opening card at Turfway and how that turned out and all the good Saturday racing that is on tap, including Cigar Mile Day and Hollywood Derby Day, etc. First order of business is the situation emanating from Churchill, and Gary Palmisano Jr. is going to join us in about 15 minutes. Gary will provide the wider overview of this herpes outbreak that has got one horse, it seems, fairly sick, and another four or five that are isolated, that are asymptomatic, but tested positive. This is, of course, a very bad time. Is there a good time for an EHV1 outbreak? The answer is no. But particularly, and it seems like over the years we've had more of these than you can count, when you're shipping horses around, it's a terrible time for this. And you end up with a horse that may have contracted and isn't showing symptoms, gets put on a van, and now goes, let's say, from Louisville to New Orleans or to wherever. And that's the problem with this. And so everybody has to lock down for the most part for 2 weeks. And, shelter in place, as it were. You isolate barns. Might not be a bad... we haven't had one of these discussions in a while, but Dr. Alday always does a great job explaining it. And, you got to... the vans have to be very carefully disinfected. It's just a bad time for it, and particularly... With some of the needs of horsemen to find places to run their horse. And the first impact was seen with Churchill locking down for 2 weeks, at least. At every time you have another positive or you have another barn affected, if the positives come in an isolated barn that is, under quarantine, that at least is a control group. But if it is anywhere else on the backstretch, the clock restarts. And what was the one? Must have been 10 years ago, right? The one that started off of the Ramsey farm, and it just was a complete mess for 2 months, and then it was complicated. If you remember this, and I may be conflating a few of these incidents, but there were the polo. Remember the polo ponies that came over? What was it? It was Argentinian polo ponies, and there was also a thing with German show horses, and this all it all just came together in a nightmare of EHV1, and it took months to straighten out. The polo, if I remember this correctly, the polo ponies that are very valuable, a bunch ended up having to be put down. It's a bad deal. Neurologic, and one thing about, and I'm going to get Dr. Alday, if not today, soon, and I am curious. It popped in my head this morning as I was kind of tracking this scenario, and Darren Rogers put out a advisory, a press release last night that I think helped everybody get a handle on where things were, because there were rumors swirling that other tracks were having to lock down, and including fairgrounds, but everybody's pretty much locking out. No horses from Churchill can come in. And the first immediate impact of that was the Foley Barn with Obesos, who was ready to contest Saturday's Cigar Mile. So that hurt. And in fact, Cigar Mile took a couple of unscheduled and unwelcome hits, because in addition to Obesos having to come out, the field came together with seven horses, and it would have had eight, but Baby Yoda took sick. So no Baby Yoda. So you would have had a field of eight, and Baby Yoda made it seven, and then here came Obesos, who was a solid fifth in the Breeders' Cup Sprint. He was going to stretch back out, and was a consideration from off the pace, you would think, in the Cigar Mile. So I feel badly for everybody involved there in the Foley Barn, and Jose Ortiz was going to take the call. The rest of that group, very, very quickly, Zandon turning back to the one-turn mile, and interesting, just because he's never, ever since his maiden win, which came at six at Belmont, he hasn't, gone this trip or close to it. So the shortest other stake try was a mile and an eighth. So Zandon, an interesting prospect here, coming out of the second behind Taba in the Pennsylvania Derby. So Zandon, major player, obviously, and Mind Control makes his final career start, the six-year-old. What a great career he's had. $1.7 million. Greg Sacco and Todd Pletcher doing the work for the Brunetti family. And what a nice horse he's been. And he actually, it's funny, you think of Mind Control as more of a, 7/8 type sprinter, but he's 4 for 5 at a mile. And with a placement, and he's also 4-7 at Aqueduct. So never off the board at Aqueduct, and never worse than second in five tries going a mile. So Mind Control, Zandon, the major principals. Peter Miller ships in with Get Her Number for Gary Barber, and Gary starting to warm up as the temperatures drop. I mentioned earlier in the week, Barber with a couple of weekend stake wins. And Get Her Number, far from impossible. He actually, a horse that hasn't tried a mile, but has, has that tactical kind of speed, very well might be in his wheelhouse. He's been sprinting of late, after a little stint on turf, and of course, going back to his three-year-old year, took some shots on the Derby trail. So White of Barrio in here too for Safi Joseph, and I do know that Safi, I think it was, from what I understand, I think a horse, one of the horses that has had the herpy issue, one of them I think is a Safi horse. So I'm sure they're on guard trying to you know, make sure everybody is okay. This one, as it happens, White Barrio has been at Gulfstream, so preparing. And actually, he's got a very nice string. He also was in the Pennsylvania Derby, having set the pace. And he actually has been working really well for this. And White Barrio is going to be a square enough number. Certainly wouldn't think he's, you know, obviously Zandon and Mind Control and Get Her Number are your first three choices. So I guess White Barrio probably your fourth choice, right? 8-1-ish. Feels about right. Double Crown in here, too, for Norm Cash off the Kelso win. And your other player is Outlier for Cash as well. First stake try for this four-year-old, not this time. And as it happens, this is funny that I see Outlier in here because our friend Lenny Cohn, Cohn's Kosher in St. Louis. Lenny and partner Pedro Gonzalez. I think we talked about this now gelding, but earlier on, it was a $375,000 Keeneland yearling. I haven't talked to Lenny. Lenny, one of our partners and wonderful supporter of the game. The rest of that action at Aqueduct on Saturday, the Demoiselle, the Remsen, and the Gopher Wand. Nice. I think each of them originally drew seven. So we'll get into that as the morning progresses, and certainly tomorrow on TwinSpires Weekend Preview, we'll go through everything. All right, I'm just getting a word from Joe Clancy will join us today. In fact, let me give you the rundown. I mentioned G-Pal, Gary Palmisano Jr., here in just a couple of minutes. John Parada, as we begin our holiday season, it is December 1st, as my parents, I don't know why this pops in my head, as my parents, they're one of those couples that would say rabbit, rabbit to each other on the first of the month. I've never actually bothered to look this up. Don't ask me. I'm sure some of you are aware of this. I never understood it, but it's funny. It's making me smile just now, knowing it's the first of the month, and they used to do that. I'd be downstairs, and let's say my mother was in the kitchen, and my father would come in, and they'd say rabbit, 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 rabbit. I look it up. I somebody tell me what it means. I do know that some of you that had the Oaklawn calendar from last year, and I can't, where's mine? Mine's, I think, underneath the Colgate calendar. I've got like five calendars hanging. Today is not December 1st on your Oaklawn calendar. Today is November 31st. I don't ask me, but Steve Stang, I know Steve Stang tweeted to me and Hammer about his calendar. And so did John Dowd. So thanks, guys. It's the funniest thing. November 31st. It's a bonus. You get a bonus day. It's leap. It's a leap day in November. Yeah, it was very funny. So you got an extra day. So for some of you, tomorrow, I guess, is December 1st. I don't know. John Parada is going to join us. And as mentioned, we are starting our seasonal book ideas. And we'll review and we'll actually get an interview in with Catherine Scanlon next week, next Thursday. Catherine's going to join us. And I'm looking forward to this. This is the book... when it comes to Scanlon, Kick the Latch. And I've been working to get Catherine on the show, and we finally connected yesterday. So Andy Serling is the one who told you about the book, and Catherine will join us next Thursday. I'll be, where will I be? I'll be at Los Al. And I think she's on the West Coast, too. So you'll hear all about Kick the Latch, which Andy raved about and has actually received a ton of raves. So looking forward to that. But John is going to join us. And, of course, his most recent title, not fiction or not, you know, a race tracker chronicle, but the Thoroughbred Investor's Bible. And John worked on this for several years. And in fact, there were hints in here in his book about how to approach a horse like Flightline. So I'm going to let John riff on that. I want to let John touch on the changes. I mean, because John has seen, you know, the fluctuations in the marketplace over the years. So get John's thoughts. I mean, because I know that he was just bewildered, it seemed, at the time by the price on the Flightline share for what it, you know, for where it went. And I'm curious, you know, if he, you know, what his thought is, you know, now, and just how the marketplace has changed. You know, because John was around for the absolute, you know, the the bull market of bull markets when it came to the 80s and bloodstock. So his insights and you know, over the horizon of the game. Tony Black, I want to get Tony in today and catch up with Tony again. And the interesting name that came up, of course, with Kate DeMasi yesterday. And I gotta say, I don't flog visits or segments, you know, too much. They're out there for everybody to enjoy, and you know, everybody digests the show the way they want. And it was organic the way it came about. Having Kate DeMasi and Mark Glatt yesterday back to back, and the interesting coincidence of them both reaching career earnings milestones over the weekend with their stake winners was just kind of, you know, happenstance and you know, serendipitous. If you saw my tweet this morning, the two of them are horsemen's horsemen. Between them, almost 3,000 wins. And you know, really, they really kind of fulfill an underappreciated segment of the game. I mean, because neither of them are trainers that are out there advertising, and if, for instance, you may have noticed, neither of them, I didn't have Twitter handles or Facebook links for them. You know, they're not out there, you know, promoting, and not that it's bad, that, you know, it's certainly not a knock on those that do, but, you know, there's incredibly talented, adept, savvy horse trainers out there that are absolutely worthy of having, you know, top dollar stock, and these were two of them back to back that I got off the air and I just was so pleased that, I mean, just the way it just sort of happened to have them both on like that. So, and, you know, and here they are, I mean, having the best years of their career with 4 weeks to go, and they're in, respectively, I think, Glatt in his 30th, give or take, year training, and DeMasi, you know, 35, give or take. Yeah, so. That from that standpoint, it's actually heartening that they're still on the upswing at this late stage. But it's certainly not because they're drawing attention to themselves, you know, on social media. So I'm happy to do it for them. Joe Clancy later. Dave Hill will do NFL. And Dave, with kind of a 500-ish week, we'll get Dave's take. I'm curious, actually, if he's bet any soccer either as well. Actually, it's funny. I hadn't watched 1 minute of the soccer until watching the U.S. Game. Was that Tuesday? And which was really, I mean, that was a nail-biter. And exciting, as exciting as soccer gets. And that's no knock. But then yesterday, actually, I watched another good game. That Mexico game was terrific. And I'm going to take in some racing today, too. But I'll probably slap on some more World Cup today. But I'm curious if Dave's betted at all. I want to get Seth Merrow in. We didn't get to Seth yesterday. And Rich Eng, as promised. And speaking of books, the chance to talk to Rich about the release of version 2, the updated Betting on Horse Racing for Dummies. It is ready to ship. So, Rich Eng later, too. All right, full day. Let me get to Gary in here and get an update on what is going on and how owners in particular should expect, and trainers, everybody should expect how they're going to deal with the EHV1 outbreak at, for now, Churchill and hopefully nowhere else. Gary, good morning.
Hey, Mr. Steve, how you doing?
I'm good. And I would prefer to launch into a whole conversation about the Turfway season kicking off and Fairgrounds season as well. But let's give everybody the information they need to know about this outbreak and the protocols that are going to be involved here over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, so, obviously an unfortunate situation. We had the one horse that tested positive, I think, 2 days ago. That barn has 13 horses in it right now. So one horse was positive. In subsequent testing yesterday afternoon, it was revealed that five more horses have tested positive within that barn, which prompted the closure of the Churchill Downs backside for horses shipping in and out. So that barn is obviously under very intense quarantine right now with horses tested periodically and obviously monitored and looking for anything that's symptomatic. And those, the five horses that were positive have been moved to a separate, quarantine barn. The eight remaining horses are being watched and monitored carefully throughout the day and they're training at different training hours and going through all of our traditional, biosecurity protocols that we have in place for unfortunate situations like this.
How does it affect, and I'm sure there's been some tracking of horses that have left the grounds over the last, let's say, the incubation period, I think, is 48 to 72 hours. So, fairgrounds and places that traditional Oaklawn, places that the end of the meet would see, horses sent out to.
Yeah, definitely, a bit of an awkward timing for us. As you know, over the last 2 weeks, horses have been leaving, in truckloads, literally. So we're just monitoring. We're in very close communication with all of our horsemen, asking them to be extremely diligent and looking at, their horses each morning, which I know they all do, in general. Knock on wood, so far, nothing of note, but we are just kind of asking the horsemen to carefully monitor their horses, and we'll hopefully get through this thing without any more issue.
Well, the the clock basically ticks with with any positive. So the thing everybody has to do is just hold breath and just basically say to themselves, let's not get another positive, because every time you get another one, that starts the clock again. The two week
exactly. Period. Yeah. Yep, I think everybody's this is something that happens on occasion, and it's happened at other places, and it's extremely unfortunate and really just kind of bad luck. But you're exactly right. I mean, everybody just has to pause and understand that this is out of anyone's control, and we all just have to work together over the next 14 days to try to get through it together.
There you go. It's an unusual virus, and it does seem to crop up at seasonal changes more often, and it also a lot of times will crop up when 2-year-olds start getting shipped in from farms and training centers, and there's this cross pollinization. It's then the van companies have to go on alert and disinfect virtually after every shipment. Not that they don't clean the vans regularly anyway, but extra precautions, because all you need is a horse literally can lick a stall door, and the next one comes along and does the same thing, and there it is. There's a spread. So it's everybody has to pull in the same direction on this. Let's take the opportunity, Gary, then also to kick off the season at Turfway. I had Tyler Picklesheimer on Tuesday leading in, and these first 4 days of cards, so you got the holiday inaugural stake on Saturday. Just feels like it's going to be a tremendous season at Florence.
Yeah, pretty excited about it. I was there last night for opening night. Obviously, we have the new building there. So it's a nice building, nice setup. But the horsemen have responded to Turfway, and obviously, thanks to the KTDF dollars and the Kentucky Circuit strength right now, it's allowed a lot of our horsemen to make Turfway home this winter. Churchill Downs committed to opening the trackside training facility here in Louisville. So I think there's an additional 400 horses that are stabled over there this winter, which provides another outlet for horsemen that want to participate in racing in Kentucky to be here. And I think we're going to see the traditional big fields and chaotic results at Turfway over the winter, and you're going to see the Brad Coxes and the Steve Asmussens and the Kenny McPeaks, as well as the traditional Turfway folks, the Bill Morries of the world, show up there and be well represented.
Well, as it happens, I'll use that as an opening as I reach around my insane desk for last night's results, because I did, as it happens, print out the card, and there we go. Let me say, for goodness sake, how does this happen? I had the whole thing right here. You had a pretty formful night, and we should first of all note the four wins by Corrales, who is just an increasingly evident force, and a guy that he actually won the first of the season for Gennaro Garcia, but yep. Then went on and won for Charlie DiMario, won for Eric Foster and Foster Family Racing, that Icy River. And then won, I think, the nightcap too, didn't he? Or no, the seventh intrigue for Mike Maker. Maker won a pair. And you had Brad Cox, who we talked to the other day. Brad Cox, we had Botanical, and Botanical made 3-2 look like an absolute gift, 488. winning by 10 with Chris Landeros. And Landeros had a pair of wins.
Yeah, he sure did. Chris Landeros, now represented by Brad Cox's son, who is his agent. So you'll see a lot of Landeros and Cox teaming up at Turfway this winter. And you're spot on. Corrales has really kind of burst onto the scene here. He cut his teeth at Turfway last winter, having a really strong meet, riding a lot of winners for Maker and Ward and those types of folks. And I think he carried the momentum throughout the season and made a real positive impact on multiple meets here in Kentucky, and evident by his four wins last night. He's obviously the leading favorite in the clubhouse to win the riding title there.
Well, the Turfway season up and running. I think the biggest price we had was the Nightcap, 5-1. Yeah, 1270. That card, that result.
That doesn't happen often.
No, I was going to say that this may be an outlier when we get rolling. We may look back and say that was the chalkiest card of the entire meet. The challenge, as I said to Tyler the other day, is going to be, digging through these PPs. I mean, almost every race is going to have 12, 10, 11, 12, it seems. And when you look down the last race, like if you look at the chart, here's the allowance seventh that Intrigue won, came out of Keeneland. Runner-up and third-place finisher came out of Churchill. Indiana, fourth. Presque Isle, on and on. You have just this melange of Belterra, Laurel, Kentucky Downs, you name it. Here's a horse that ran at Santa Anita in October, Dees Delight, that finished fifth in that 15 claimer in the fourth race. So you're really going to have to mix and match, and fig users, and you're going to have to really figure out how to approach these cards, because it's going to be fun.
It's a fun handicapping puzzle there. Obviously, I rely on horses pretty heavily that have passed poly or all weather experience there, just because the track is unique and different, but it is a lot of fun to handicap those races. There are always big fields, and to your point, horses coming from all different parts of the country, so it's a good time for sure.
Gary Palmisano with us. First order of business was catching up on the lockdown for a couple of weeks at Churchill, and hoping that the herpes spread is contained. We'll monitor that. And the other topic we should touch on too, you're one of your favorites, obviously, down to Fairgrounds, and kind of a watch and see right now on getting that grass grown and having the turf firm up after a crazy series of events damaged the growth cycle. Some thoughts, Gary, about how things will unfold here over the next 4 to 6 weeks?
Yeah, I think it's been documented that we've had some challenges down there, some things that are pretty unprecedented for Fairgrounds. We've had the same team in place there for a really long time, and the same resources, and for whatever reason, Mother Nature just wasn't on our side there this year, and it's kind of caused a domino effect. But the course is progressing. I know they got some rain there yesterday. We've done multiple rounds of reseeding on the inner portion and the outer portion of the course. So right now we're very hopeful that, we kind of have our eye on that Santa Super Saturday card. We're all going to fly down there. Me personally, as well as a couple of our team members, will fly down there middle next week or the week after and kind of walk the course and make some assessments. But we're eyeing late December to hopefully get back on the course there and move forward with the meet. I do have to mention, as a horse player, that there is a pick five carryover down there today. That pick five takeout was reduced from 25% to 15% in advance of this meet. So that is a good wagering opportunity there today on what might be a slow Thursday in horse player land. So highly recommend tuning in down there and taking advantage of that that takeout reduction and carryover at Fairgrounds today.
The You know, it's funny because I didn't, Marcus and I talked about the meet and we didn't touch on that, but the black gold provision is gone.
Yeah. So the pick five is a standard customary pick five, you know, with the carryover provision, the early pick five and the late pick five. And I should mention that carryover is on the late pick five today. Similar to here at Churchill, any carryover on a pick five at Fairgrounds will go to the late pick five. There's also a pick six down there that, you know, we put in this year. It hasn't got off to a rousing start. It is the same rules as the Naira and the Keeneland pick six with a 15% takeout dollar minimum. I expect that pool to pick up steam. It's weird. The pick six markets are so strange. If you're not in New York or California, it seems really hard for the traditional pick six to flourish. But, you know, we're interested in that concept of the dollar pick six, similar again to Naira and Keeneland, where it's more of that traditional style pick six that I think players, you know, may enjoy. Particularly players that have been pick six players in the past. So we're looking forward to that thing sort of ramping up and getting a little more awareness about that wager. But yeah, so lots going on the wagering front at Fairgrounds. And now that Churchill's wrapping up, I think Fairgrounds becomes kind of a top of mind property for horse players.
Well, and one part of the Fairgrounds season that is particularly notable is how many of the two-year-old stars essentially are going to approach their three-year-old campaigns via the Louisiana Derby and the Fairgrounds Oaks run-up.
Absolutely. I think I saw an article somewhere that seven of the nine winners from Churchill over the weekend are headed to New Orleans. You're exactly right. I'm proud of the team down there. They got creative with their Road to the Derby schedule. They stretched that Louisiana Derby out to 1 3/16, and I think trainers have responded well to that that move to give their horse a little more distance going into the Derby. Obviously, Epicenter last year made every Fairgrounds three-year-old prep a stop on the way to his run in the Derby, and I would expect similar down there. You have Steve, you have Brad, you have Kenny McPeak. They're down there with their best ones, and I would totally expect them to use numerous races at Fairgrounds to prep their three-year-olds.
Well, you missed the biggest star in the galaxy, the Amos that's famous.
Amos, yep. She's headed down there. I would expect her to show up most likely in the I heard Tom's comment that he might be thinking Derby, so I don't know where she's going to show up, but.
The Rachel. Looks like the Rachel.
Yeah. She's headed down there probably for a little time off, and then she'll pop up there in February and be ready to rock and roll. She's an exciting prospect, no doubt.
Gary Palmisano Jr., everybody. Gary, I appreciate this, and thanks for the heads up on the carryover, a little under 11,000. That set of races starts in race four with a nickel non-three, essentially. Then there's a Louisiana-bred second-level allowance, Louisiana-bred non-winners of three lifetime, and two-year-old fillies going 1 mile and 70. Everybody has started, too, so there isn't any first-time starter mysteries in that seventh race. And the anchor leg is a law-bred non-winners of two lifetime going three-quarters. Field size 6x6x8x9x9. So it feels kind of approachable, and I printed the PPs, and I will look at it myself.
There you go. I would recommend a text to a McGoey or a Schechtschneider just to get some impact or some feedback. But looking forward to getting down there, getting some good food and getting back on the turf.
Absolutely. Gary Palmisano Jr., everybody, the director of racing for all of the CDI properties. Gary, I appreciate it. If we don't talk on air anyway, happy holidays, and we'll see you soon.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Really appreciate that. And thanks to the folks out there that made a really successful Churchill Downs meet, and look forward to Turfway and Fairgrounds this winter. Appreciate all your help.
Not at all, and looking forward to getting down to Fairgrounds myself as well. Thanks to Gary for the update. And now let's just try to keep them all healthy the rest of the way. Fingers crossed. All right. We are going to get John in here. John Pirata. I'm just doing something I learned on the phone. So I if you want to follow, by the way, follow Gary if you haven't. Gary Pal Jr. Gary P-A-L-J-R. Gary Pomisano Jr. John's going to join us, and I also, for whatever reason, will use it as the opportunity. I talked to Jay Hovde yesterday, and Hovde's got a new feed, not a new gig per se, but Hovde on Film, and he kind of hinted about this to me the other day. Or maybe a month ago, and going to certainly get Jay to visit. He also pushed a new Amazon Prime series, and Tina and I watched the first two episodes last night. The English, it's a Western. And it is, first two episodes, terrific. Emily Blunt, who we love from so many vehicles, she stars as a British aristocrat, essentially, that comes to the United States in the late 1890, give or take. And It's interesting. It's sort of, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly meets My Fair Lady, I guess, something like that. It's very good. The first episode in particular, and it's clearly a relationship between her and a native, an interesting native character who looks like served in the cavalry and. The premise seems great, and it's got that sort of spaghetti Western, very much a spaghetti Western feel to it. For those of you that like Sergio Leone and you know that ilk, Hovde in particular loves that. I think that's his favorite genre. John Pirata, good morning.
Hey Steve, how's it going?
Excellent, excellent. I was just talking about Hovde's. You know, Hovde's new Hovde on Film.
Oh, there's one of the things I wanted to talk about. I'm excited about it. I've always told him. I told him the other day. You know, he missed his calling because he could have been not only Siskel and Ebert, but had a Hopper without the hats. His insight into film has always been so vast that it's always just amazed me. When we were doing Luck, he would come up with his references that actually he could stump David Milch, if they could imagine that. David really respected him for that. And everybody knows that's saying a lot.
You know, I invoked you and Jay and Bill Barish. Last night I taped an episode. Dan Delgado, who I featured after Dave Hill had let us know about the Let It Ride podcast. Oh, yeah. I don't know if you heard this when Dan was on, but Dave had somehow, you know, I don't even know how it even came up on the show, but he made all of us aware of this. It's called the Jockey Club. And after the dining room at Hialeah in Let It Ride. And it's a scene by scene podcast that Dan has done, and he invited me to do one of the scenes, and I was delighted. But I invoked the three of you, the three-headed luck writing monster yesterday.
That's fun.
Yeah.
So, the whole cycle of luck and movies and racing, Jay did a great review on Banshees of Inisherin, the new Colin Farrell, Brendan Gleeson movie that's just been released recently, set in rural Ireland. And of course, we were all looking forward to it because of Kerry Condon's involvement as one of the stars, and because we all got to know her so well. And Jay wrote a lot of her stuff because she's a girl jockey in the show, and Jay might know something about that with some insight. So we were looking forward to that, and I really appreciated his his insight into that movie. And Terry's performance was, I think she'll be considered for awards all over the place for it. If you haven't seen it yet, you should definitely go see it. It's not a bright and cheerful movie. Let's put it that way. But it's in rural Ireland, and the setting becomes a character. The pubs and the pub that they spend a lot of time in, and just the countryside, very pensive. But and then nicely you mentioned Bill Barish. I spoke to Bill just yesterday, actually. Author of Laughing in the Hills, one of the 50 best sports books ever written, that any racing person should definitely get their hands on. And his other book, Fine Place to Daydream, it's about steeple chasing. That's really another one that should be on everybody's list of a good read.
Well, and the book of his, the most recent, and actually he may have had something come out since, but and this is we're sort of kicking off our December lead in when it comes to books, which we recommend every year as a welcome Christmas gift, and we'll get to all the titles this year, the equine titles and equine adjacent, Long Way Home, as well, which ended
as
up
well.
Right. It ended up being a somewhat prescient,
very, very much so
topic. Right. It's sort of like J.D. Vance's book, except not without the without the fraudulent posturing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just extremely blessed to be involved with two guys like Hovde and Barish, because they're such wonderful writers. Bill wrote another book called An Angle on the World, which came out a couple of years ago, and it didn't get much exposure, but it's really definitely worth reading. It's Dispatches and Dispersions from the New Yorker, because he had a lot in the New Yorker. That's another one it's not a horse racing oriented, but it is. He's multidimensional. He's not like me. I'm kind of, doesn't have a horse involved. I'll run out of gas pretty fast.
That's funny.
I am making a point of pointing out to everybody that had they read Thoroughbred Investor's Bible, when it came out and opened to chapter 9, they might have had a share in Flight Line or a piece of him. That because it's got a picture of Terry Stinley holding up the Derby trophy there, and it explains why shared ownership, which I've been an advocate of that. And you have too, your stable, and that shared ownership is really the way to not only involve people in the game, but it's a way for people to get their feet wet and have less risk until they find the level that they want to be involved.
Exactly, and John, you've essentially been around for the entire introduction, starting with Cott Campbell, certainly with Dogwood.
Sure.
I mean, you've seen the evolution of the partnership concept. And I one thing you and I have not discussed, the micro-share element. What's your view on this? I'm realizing I never asked you this.
You know, it's funny to say that. But you know, yes, I was involved because I knew Cott Campbell and Terry Kane. Terry was, you know, we all, back in those days, I did my partnerships and syndicates under Star Racing. Star Stable was my racing name, Racing Stable. And I did dabble with the idea back in the late 90s, early 2000s of club racing, which was basically the same idea of the micro share thing. Whereas you joined this club, you had a little tiny piece. You didn't have enough that you knew you'd be making any decisions on what races to go in or what horses to buy. You were putting that responsibility with someone else, but it gave you a participant. It's like the people look in any football stadium, hockey stadium, any place. They've all got the jerseys on. They've got their Miami Dolphins, the New York Jets, whatever, jerseys on when they go to these games. It's the same thing. You get people on board as fans and rooting for their team, and then it becomes their team, that becomes their horse. So I had this idea, and I fooled with it a little bit and didn't get any further. But, I mean, I give credit to the people who persisted. Back then, we didn't really do anything with it because there was a few people that I talked to about this, and we were going to do something with it. But we were put off by SEC and, investment regulations, because if you got into anything that was an investment, the securities rules came into effect. So just let it go. But I think it's another thing. Anything that grows the game on the horse side, because you've got fan duels and stuff like that that are going for the gambling side. And don't take me wrong. I don't dismiss gambling. Gambling is probably the biggest part of what keeps horse racing going. If you couldn't bet on it, you know, it would be a rich man's hobby. But they've got that side. They're, when they have a drag line on a golf match that you're watching, they got a drag line telling you what the odds are. You know, gambling has invaded every aspect of our lives. So the horse side, investing, getting people to invest, whatever. Some of them are a couple hundred bucks, I think, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So. I mean, what's wrong with that? You know, like, that's my horse. My horse is running. Everybody come on over. We'll have a party. We'll watch my horse on TV. Oh, what'd you win? Well, my horse won. You know, my team won. That's all. So that's.
I tend to agree. And I've been, I won't say ambivalent, but yeah, there's been a lot of criticism leveled in the direction of the operations from a standpoint of, you know, the financials and how, you know, the micro share buyer is not going to essentially, you know,
you're never
going to
make
return.
Anything. No. You're never going to make any money on it.
But that's
don't
not
look at it as an investment. It
exactly.
Be looked at
exactly.
As an investment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's yeah. You know, it's no different than buying a $300 game jersey to wear.
Right.
It's.
Right.
Very similar to that, actually, and having an association, and there's going to be plenty of people that participate in it that are going to then go take the next step. I mean, it's a gateway introduction, you know, much like what we did was a gateway, a $500 buy-in, a club concept. You know, with Gary Siaka and Chuck Simon absorbing essentially the training expenses, and plenty of people went on to then, you know, get involved in a bigger way.
And the ones that didn't get involved in a bigger way, like the level that they were at, and that's fine too.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yep.
it's something for everyone. And this is one thing I don't want to start on my books now, but Thoroughbred Investor's Bible, it's one of the things that I talk about in every aspect is the reliability, the integrity of the people you're dealing with, because there are so many people that have come and gone from the horse business because they came in and they talked to some guy at the country club or in a restaurant and got convinced that the guy knew where the next secretariat was coming from and put their money in with them and got fleeced. And it still goes on today, goes on and on and on. And in every jurisdiction where horses race, people are naive and listen to the wrong person. So I keep stressing that you need to, because I'm sure there are going to be a million microshare things that come up and people try to pitch them. But, you know, you have to do your due diligence like anything else. You don't go buy a horse. One of the things I try to say is don't buy a horse if either you or your person you trust hasn't touched it. So, or a person you trust, that's the key point.
Exactly. And we've had that conversation too, with any number of individuals about, you know, putting a team together. I have those discussions with any number of owners. I mean, Al Gold has addressed this, recently, Joe Besseker, we touched on this and have had a parade actually of these discussions. David and Gordo, the post Breeders' Cup Classic. If you missed that hour with David, highly recommend. I do want to also, since Flightline is kind of a linchpin to discussions and used it as a point of reference for Chapter 9, I am curious, John, how you are further viewing what transpired with that share. Because at the time, and again, the post Breeders' Cup Classic Monday show from Keeneland, from the sales ring, actually, with Sid and David, and we heard from John Sadler, etc. But Sid explained in great detail what was going on with that share, and then after the purchase of it for a what seems like a super premium, came back and followed it up. And I am curious about your thoughts about how that marketplace and through that lens, how it's changed, John, in the decades that you've been involved, because you've seen, you know, all the fluctuations in the marketplace when it comes to this. And we now seem to be in a very acute period of shopping, of groups shopping specifically to make stallions. And how new is that as an approach in your view? And what's your whole thoughts overall on how this has morphed in the last couple of years?
Well, I think it's been more than the last couple, but you're identifying a trend that's probably, if you wanted to go back to Seth Hancock at Claiborne and Secretariat when he's, you know, syndicated him. And that was one of the focal points because he was such a high profile horse, that you could say, this is when people started to recognize that horses could be used as an investment vehicle. Stallions, there's plenty of people that made livings and made fortunes and, in just investing in stallion shares. And it used to be, if you go back as far as Northern Dancer, he was a syndicated horse. He was either 32 or 34. I'm sure somebody will correct me. 32 or 34 shares. And back then you got to breed one mare to him on your share. And of course this has expanded now. Most syndicates are still 40 and some are 50. I was thinking that they would do a 50 on Flightline just because of the numbers, but it has changed so much. For a long time there, when the market went to, there was a trend towards selling breedings with no guarantee, where you just got to bring your mare to the stallion and have a breeding, and you had to pay no matter whether she got in fall or not. Those things are all transitioned through to we're back to live foal. You pay your stud fee in October or November most of the time, but you have a live foal guarantee or a rate of return if your mare doesn't produce or have a viable foal. So there became a very succinct way of figuring it, because you could say, okay, if the stallion can breed this many mares, he can have this many foals, and he can do. And then you also have to take into account, which Sid has referred to many times, is that investors want to recoup most of their money within the first 3 years, because that's when the two-year-olds get to the races, and that's when, you know, the jury comes in. Because you can like a horse, you can love a stallion all you want, but if his two-year-olds can't run, the market drops. If you go to I think Ali Sheba was one of my best examples, because I think he went to stud at about 50,000 his first season, and then by his fourth season or fifth season, he was down to 10. And he had beautiful foals and just elegant, beautiful foals. And they just, I don't say they couldn't run, but by the criteria of today, they couldn't run. So you have to be able to get your money coming back in on your stud fees if you're strictly using it as an investment. And that has transitioned back around to where there are syndicates, but now they are kind of big people on big chunks of them, rather than I did a lot of syndicates. I syndicated horses in New Jersey for a few years when I lived there. And we had the leading sire. We had Papa Riccio. We had Evening Chris. We had DeFrere. Those were all leading sires in New Jersey in a small market. But I had 40 share syndicates with usually at least 35 different owners. Maybe somebody would own two, but most of them were one. Reason being that you wanted those people to send their mares to fill the horse's book and then promote them and race them and, you know, get the horse going. And now the trend is to breeding stallions, as we know, to 100 to 150 mares if you can get that many. So that there's all sorts of factors that come into play. They have to be priced right. They have to be very attractive, and they have to be competitive in the market with whatever else is being offered. Nobody does this better than Coolmore Ashford. I mean, they've managed to identify Scat Daddy as the sire line that they wanted to follow. So they have a number of horses coming off of that, but there are others doing the same thing in Kentucky. Like I said, it's come around to shared ownership, promoting the stallion, getting the return. I guess some things never change, right?
Well, and that also as a follow-up, I mean, this is always what's what's challenging about visits with you, because everything we discuss, I can think of half a dozen follow-ups, but part of that, given the agglomeration of owners with deep pockets that have come together in this pursuit of essentially, buying yearlings, specifically yearlings, as opposed to the two-year-olds in training. Not that they're not eligible. It seems like the two-year-old side of the sales game is more designed for like an Amer Zidane who is going to wants runners, you know, right now, and has got certain, you know, racetrack ambitions for performers. The yearling side has got more of this, sire making pedigree pursuit that has brought together, you know, whether it's you know, the one that Donato Lanni heads, you know, the self-styled Avengers, whether it's the Liz Crow, Brad Weisbord group. These things have now really coalesced. John, from your view, even guys like Vinny Viola and Mike Rapoli buying together, is this a positive for the marketplace?
For the marketplace, it sure is, because people say they don't compete against each other,
right?
They bring so much more to them. And as you know, in Thoroughbred Investors Bible, I did use Mike Rapoli's organization as the example of how to do it. So there you go. There's another thing. You know, you might have had a forte if you listened. To the advice, but the fact that those guys, Vinny Viola, Mike Rapoli, and Winstar, all those guys, all get together, I think it expands the opportunities, and they can afford to do so at the level that they play. So when they're buying 40 yearlings or 25 or 32-year-olds in training on top of that, that wouldn't have happened with one guy. They wouldn't have bought half of that. You know, in other words, each wouldn't have bought, if they bought 40 together, they wouldn't have each bought 20. They might have each bought 10. But it kind of fuels it. Like Terry Finley, I'm sure, will be the first to tell you that he wouldn't have gotten into Flight Line if he had to go by himself,
right,
for that much, $1 million. I think, well, let me take a shot. It's a great concept. It's back again to what we said. Shared ownership is you know, gets you in the game. So
one more breeding related question, because we discussed it so extensively, particularly with the crush of new stallions that are going to be available, starting in February. The fall crop, John, how do you view where we are? And it seemed coming into this year that the drop in production was leveling off, and you know, even though the amount of foals for this past year, it was not a significant drop, it does seem like things maybe are leveling. Is it really important or necessary that more mares either go back into production, or that, you know, it's sort of a blood from a stone concern? The pool of mares are on the racetrack right now, mm-hmm. and so if we want to increase the production and add, you know, brood mares, you're going to take them out of, you know, off the racetrack and lower, you know, the pool of available runners for season. I'm just curious what your view of this is.
Well, I think you can identify one aspect that's influenced this that I don't think you can help, which is maintenance. That's the reason that, if you want to take among others, but that's one of the reasons that the foal crop has gone down, because look how much it costs you to keep a horse, a racehorse. I remember 30, 40 years ago, you could get a horse trained for $25 a day or $24 a day or something like that. You could have a mare on a farm for $15 or $16 a day. And I'm not talking about cut rate. I'm talking about that's what you paid. That's what the going rate was. Now, the actual cost to take care of a horse these days is so high. I mean, some trainers are over $100 a day in some jurisdictions.
Well over
$100, yeah. And What does that do? Well, it makes the person who wants to race, if you've got 10 in training or if you've got 5 in training, multiply that, you know, pretty soon the numbers become fairly daunting. And you say, well, I can't keep a horse in training unless they can produce. And then if you want to take the fillies, fillies have always been the way that I've suggested that people go. If you want to step into the game, start out with fillies because they have some residual value. Everybody yep. knows those. It's almost trite now because if everybody knows that. But like you're saying that they come off the track, the fact that there are fewer to begin with, then they come off the track, and then the broodmare pool, which should really be, you shouldn't breed a mare that's got conformational faults, has no pedigree. There was a trend, I remember Fred Hooper and some of the people in Ocala years ago used to go by the mares that didn't get any bids. They'd take them at sale and just turn them out somewhere and didn't breed them, you know, to take them out of the gene pool, because there were so many during that boom period where everybody was breeding everything they could get their hands on and taking it to the market.
Right.
So, you know, it's a, there's a line somewhere that's, that tells you what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And it's, sometimes it's a judgment call, but sometimes it's, oh, well, we'll just breed her, you know? And then what do you do with the foal? You have to feed them. John Forbes used to have a great line that he would say, about racehorses. He'd say, you know, they're all maintenance. You could actually get, somebody could give you a horse for free and you couldn't make any money with them. It's because they're all maintenance. If they can't run, they can't run. So that's kind of what it all boils down to. Now, I don't know what that means as far as the future goes. Whether I guess people will always, I mean, I know people, even recently, they have a mare that can't run, but she's, oh, we love her. You know, okay, well, that's fine. Well, that's why these groups that find another career, new careers for horses. That's why they're so important, because they could take those horses and make riding horses, make show horses out of them, you know, give them another career rather than becoming into the breeding pool.
John Parada's with us, and you know, John's most recent title, the Thoroughbred Investor's Bible, and essentially a step-by-step comprehensive guide to entering the industry as an owner, as a potential breeder, from any, you know, any standpoint, and just a really complete approach to getting involved in the game. And John, give everybody, I want to ask you what else is going on in terms of what's next from a writing standpoint, and also about the club. You know, since we talked about the club, I want to talk about the Irish racing initiative. But how can everybody order all of the Parada titles?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a link on the At the Races with Steve Bick's website.
That's true.
So that's a great place to go, because you'll be looking there anyway for handicapping information and everything else. But otherwise, you know, the usual Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Have been selling quite a few books from Margaret Layton's Lockley Antiques in Paris, Kentucky. Margaret used to be with Three Chimneys. Everybody in the horse business knew her, and she started an antique and horse related antique business in Paris. She does a wonderful job. Of course, she obviously has insight into the horse game, so she has been selling a lot of my books. And you know, as I said, on your website.
Well, and that'll take the link on our page takes us to your website.
Yes, it does. And that'll take you to Barnes & Noble.
it's a little
it's a big
yeah.
cycle.
There you go.
Yeah, I wish we didn't have to go to Amazon, but that's where we all end up these days. Yeah. If you want to write anything,
I know.
They skin us for every nickel they can get, and nobody makes money selling books anymore. But but we don't do it for, that's not the sole motive for doing it. I when you say, what am I doing as far as writing, I've been working on a sequel to to If Wishes Were Horses. I've been working on that for about 5 years now. I hope to have it out. I'd hope to have it out this fall, but I guess it'll be maybe next summer if we're lucky.
All right. Well,
that's my hopes. That's my hopes. See what Hamilton Greer does next. So.
Well, all the titles, and for those that haven't read Race Tracker, the book that started it all, but there's also At the End of the Bar, which has got short stories and Half a Chance, If Wishes Were Horses, The Altar Boy 2, Out of Luck, which is for those that wanted to know what season 2 would have held for the characters in Luck, John with the art of Jen Ferguson, tells the story, and you also were able to follow it in a chapter series on America's Best Racing, if you recall. So just all the titles that John has churned out. I mean, just amazing, actually, when you think about it, John, how much, you know, in pretty short order, right? It's 10 years?
It's been a while, so I think it's been like 2 years since, other than the Bible, which was, you know, I prefer fiction, but the Bible, somebody said to me, isn't that really fiction too? Because it's about how to try to get a good racehorse, which is, you know, based on hopes and dreams anyway.
Exactly.
I kind of stepped away from fiction to do that just because I had enough people who were saying to me, well, how do you do this? How should I do this? What do you think? And so let me put it all down in writing and maybe we can go from there. Somebody said to me recently, well, you know, the people that are, it's almost preaching to the choir, because a lot of the people that buy it know some of the things that you're telling them already. And I didn't really write it for them. I wrote it for the guy that goes to the race and says, oh, this is pretty cool. I wonder how you get a racehorse or how you get involved. Oh, it's just for rich people. Or, you know, so this kind of, that's what I was trying to do, make it easier for somebody to figure it out and tell them where to look. Like I said, the rest of it's fiction.
JRParada.com if you want to go directly to John's site. And, of course, you should be following John on Twitter, too. And finally, John, the Racing Club, what's the latest? Is there going to be a season next year?
Yeah, there will be. And actually, when we get past the first of the year, I'll talk to you about it. I've got some thoughts, and I had to back off because of COVID, obviously.
Sure.
We had one horse that we raced. A Kitten's Joy filly that we raced a few times. She was placed, and then COVID came along, and then, you know, so I really kind of backed off trying to involve people because obviously nobody could go. I couldn't go check on the horses or anything. You know, as you know, I go to Ireland as often as I can, but I have a nice Churchill filly with a trainer named Joe Murphy down in Tipperary, and we're looking forward to racing her, you know, probably at Dundalk over the winter and get her started in the spring. I really enjoy the racing there. I've been to most of the 26 tracks in Ireland, and I can't help but just keep preaching how great the racing is there and how it's, I've always described Ireland as being like the U.S. was 25 years ago or 30 years ago. So, you know, when I started going over there in the 80s and 90s, I would say it's like, you know, it was like 1960 there. And in a lot of places, it still is. And the racing, when you go to the tracks, I've been to tracks there that have 50 people at them. But they're tiny little tracks. But you look around and you look, I was at Tipperary one day, my wife Maggie and I, and it was a blustery day, not that nice a day. And I looked around, there's maybe 250 people there. And we're standing down on the rail watching the races. And I look around and this guy says, hey, John, it's Aidan O'Brien. What's he doing at Tipperary with 250 people? There's a guy, you know, like one of the greatest horse trainers in the world. Hey, John, how you doing? Hey. So, you know, it's a different. It's like it was in the 60s here. You know, it really is. It's a lot of fun, but and that's what I started the Dublin Racing Club for. It was really just to create kind of a social network for people and they could come over and, you know, tell them where to stay, how to get your transportation, where to, you know, things to go visit besides racing, or go do farm visits and meet trainers and get involved that way. But we'll talk about it after the first of the year.
Okay? Very good. Excellent. Excellent.
All right.
John, I guess I'm seeing you, I guess, and Maggie next in 10 days, right? A week from today.
Yes. Week from Saturday.
Week from Saturday. There you go.
Week from Saturday. Yes, in L.A. Yes. Great, looking forward to it.
Yeah, which came as a surprise. I didn't see you this summer, but then the opportunity to be out west and see you. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, it's going to be great. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, John. John Parada, and of course, among the other significant accomplishments of John's career around the game, is responsible for this show being on Sirius XM and existing.
You're the best yearling I ever picked. No, you're the best yearling anybody ever picked.
Well, the question is, am I getting, you know, they've put in that 10-year-old restriction. You can't race past 10. I don't know if there's, is there a restriction?
No, don't tell Tina, but you're going to stud.
Easy. I'm glad. Well, she actually left Twitter this week, so that won't get back to her anytime soon. Good. Thanks, John.
Take care.
John Parada, everybody. Oh, too funny. I'm gonna get Tony in here. That's when John comes on. There's always, you know, and his, I mean, just vast experience that he's had, and that's why his, you know, his kind of long-term understanding of the way the game works, and you know, particularly from the financial standpoint, he's got a flair on that end. And so the Thoroughbred Investor's Bible, a reference piece that can help anybody, that even if you have experience in the game. So thanks to John. Got to get just making a decision here. Case, I think maybe we'll take the break here instead. And I got Tony coming and Joe Clancy, Dave Hill, Seth Merrow, Rich Eng. Let's take our only break, I think, of the morning. Okay, so you ready for me to step away? You are. There we go. Beautiful. So as we do that, before Tony comes and joins us, give you a quick glance at some of those other spots that I referenced early. Dave Brennigan, Nick Tamaro tomorrow to talk New York. The Demoiselle, which I suppose Julia Shining, the Dreaming of Julia, is going to be the clear favorite for Stone Street and Todd Pletcher. Louis Saez aboard. But, one start and stretching through the mile and an eighth. And she's bred for it, don't get me wrong, between, you know, being by Curlin and out of Dreaming of Julia. But still, that's demanding. Go from 7 furlongs to 9. But she's the horse to beat. No two ways about it. John Service shows up with Tuskegee Airmen in the Remsen. And you've also got the New York bred Arctic Arrogance, the Bromans, the Frosted Colt out of the Sleepy Hollow Wind. Horacio De Paz has a Broman bred as well, but this for Rupp Racing. And that's a progressive horse that was second to Arthur Garrigus. And again, the mile and the eighth. As always, the interesting wrinkle when it comes to these two standards on the calendar for two-year-olds. And then the Gopher Wand, which got a big, bulky field, including, speaking of John Service, and our guy, Will Schwartz. There's Love in the Air, who constantly draws inside. It's unbelievable. She drew the rail. She's drawn the rail three of her last four starts. Love in the Air. My man Siaka and Louie Laz with Exotic West. And of course, things went wrong in the turn back the alarm when kind of banged the gate and lost Luzzy. Dylan Davis gets back aboard. Exotic West in here, but this is a big, full, fun field. Battle Bling for Atrus off the win in the turn back the alarm. There's a lot of good horses lining up in here. Bankstein for the McMahons and Hiddenbrook, Terra Nova, the New York bred, and others. Betsy Blue. So, and then the Cigar Mile that we talked about earlier. You've got the two Maryland Juvenile Championship races, and they're both okay. The Sandpiper and the inaugural at Tampa as the soon-to-be three-year-old path gets going to the Tampa Bay Derby and the Florida Oaks. Big bulky field in the Holiday inaugural at Turfway. And Del Mar. We'll do Del Mar separately, maybe with Rich Ang later. But the Hollywood Derby. They're coming from a few different points on the compass. Back with Tony Black after this.
It's At the Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me.